A woman, who heard screams, and sounds as if of blows, but no sound of shots, notified the police. Policeman Albert Kattenborn went to the place, but was unable to get in. He lifted a boy through the transom. The boy unbolted the door. On the floor lay Fink, two bullet wounds in his chest, and one in his left wrist, which was powder marked. He was dead. There was money in his pockets, and the cash register had not been touched. No weapon was found. The man had died instantly, or almost instantly. There was a theory that the murderer had crawled through the transom. A hinge on this transom was broken, but there was no statement as to the look of this break, as indicating recency, or not. The transom was so narrow that policeman Kattenborn had to lift a boy through it. It would have to be thought that, having sneaked noiselessly through this transom, the murderer then, with much difficulty, left the room the same way, instead of simply unbolting the door. It might be thought that the murderer had climbed up, outside, and had fired through the transom. But Fink's wrist was powder burned, indicating that he had not been fired at from a distance. More than 2 years later, Police Commissioner Mulrooney, in a radio talk, called this murder, in a closed room, an insoluble mystery. 13. If a man was scorched, though upon his clothes there was no sign of fire, it could be that the woman of Whitley Bay, who told of having found her sister burned to death on an unscorched bed, reported accurately. If the woman confessed that she had lied, that ends the mystery, or that stimulates interest. The statement that somebody, operated upon by the police, or by a coroner, confessed, has the meaning that has a statement that under pressure an apple produces cider. However, this analogy breaks down. I have never heard of an apple that would, if properly pressed, yield cider, if wanted, or ginger ale, if required, or home brew, all according to what was wanted. Once upon a time, when mine was an undeveloped suspiciousness, and I'd let dogmatists pull their pedantries over my perceptions, I nevertheless collected occasional notes upon what seemed to me to be unexplained phenomena. I don't do things mildly, and at the same time much enjoy myself in various ways, I act as if trying to make allness out of something. A search for the unexplained became an obsession. I undertook the job of going through all scientific periodicals, at least by way of indexes, published in English and French, from the year 1800, available in the libraries of New York and London. As I went along, with my little suspicions in their infancies, new subjects appeared to me something queer about some hailstorms, the odd and the unexplained in archaeological discoveries, and in Arctic explorations. By the time I got through with the grand tour, as I called this search of all available periodicals, to distinguish it from special investigations, I was interested in so many subjects that had cropped up later, or that I had missed earlier, that I made the tour all over again and then again had the same experience, and had to go touring again and so on until now it is my recognition that in every field of phenomena and in later years I have multiplied my subjects by very much shifting to. The newspapers is somewhere the unexplained, or the irreconcilable, or the mysterious in unformulable motions of all planets, volcanic eruptions, murders, hailstorms, protective colorations of insects, chemical reactions, disappearances of human beings, stars, comets, juries, diseases, cats, lampposts, newly married couples, cathode rays, hoaxes, impostures, wars, births, deaths. Everywhere is the tabooed, or the disregarded. The monks of science dwell in smug jerrys that are walled away from event jungles. Or some of them do. Nowadays a good many of them are going native. There are scientific dervishes who whirl amok, brandishing startling statements, but mostly they whirl not far from their origins, and their excitements are exaggerations of old-fashioned complacencies. Because of several cases that I have noted, the subject of fires attracted my attention. One reads hundreds of accounts of fires, and many of them are mysterious, but one's ruling thought is that the unexplained would be renderable in terms of accidents, carelessness, or arson, if one knew all the circumstances. But keep this subject in mind, and, as in every other field of phenomena, one comes upon cases that are irreconcilables. Glasgow News, May 20, 1878. Doings in John Shattuck's farmhouse, near Bridgewater. Fires had started up unaccountably. A superintendent of police investigated and suspected a servant girl, Anne Kidner, aged 12, because he had seen a hayrick flame, while she was passing it. Loud raps were heard. Things in the house, such as dishes and loaves of bread, moved about. The policeman ignored whatever he could not explain, and arrested the girl, accusing her of tossing lighted matches. But a magistrate freed her, saying that the evidence was insufficient. There is a story of devilish manifestations, in the Quebec Daily Mercury, October 6, 1880. For 2 weeks, in the Hudson Hotel, in the town of Hudson, on the Ottawa River, furniture had been given to disorderly conduct, the beds had been especially excitable. A fire had broken out in a stall in the stable. This fire was quenched, but another fire broke out. A priest was sent for, and he sprinkled the stable with holy water. The stable burned down. There are several recorded cases of such fires ending with the burning of buildings, but a similarity that runs through the great majority of the stories is of fires localized in special places, and not extending. They are oftenest in the presence of a girl, aged from 12 to 20, but seldom do they occur at night, when they would be most dangerous. It is a peculiarity. See back to the case of the fires in the house in Bedford. It seems that, if those fires had been ordinary fires, the house would have burned down. The cases are of fires, in unscorched surroundings. New Zealand Times, December 9, 1886. Copying from the San Francisco Bulletin, about October 14, that Willie Broff, 12 years old, who had caused excitement in the town of Turlock, Madison Co., Cal., by setting things afire, by his glance, had been expelled from the Turlock school, because of his freaks. His parents had cast him off, believing him to be possessed by a devil, but a farmer had taken him in, and had sent him to school. On the first day, there were 5 fires in the school, one in the center of the ceiling, one in the teacher's desk, one in her wardrobe, and 2 on the wall. The boy discovered all, and cried from fright. The trustees met and expelled him, that night. For another account, see the New York Herald, October 16, 1886. Setting fire to teacher's desk, or to her wardrobe, is understandable, and would have been more understandable to me, when I was 12 years old, but in terms of no known powers of mischievous youngsters, can there be an explanation of setting a ceiling, or walls, afire? It seems to me that no yarn spinner would have thought of any such particular, or would have made his story look improbable with it, if he had thought of it. I have other accounts in which similar statements occur. This particular of fires on walls is unknown in standardized yarns of uncanny doings. If writers of subsequent accounts probably had never heard of Willie Broff, it is improbable that several of them could invent, or would invent, anything so unlikely. It seems that my reasoning is that, under some circumstances, if something is highly unlikely, it is probable. John Stuart Mill missed that. Upon the 6th of August, 1887, in a little, 2-story frame house, in Victoria Street, Woodstock, New Brunswick, occupied by Reginald C. Hoyt, his wife, 4 children of his own, and 2 nieces, fires broke out. See the New York World, August 8, 1887. Within a few hours, there were about 40 fires. They were fires in unscorched surroundings. They did not extend to their surroundings, because they were immediately put out, or because some unknown condition limited them. The fires can be traced to no human agency, and even the most skeptical are staggered. Now a curtain, high up and out of reach, would burst into flames, then a bed quilt in another room, a basket of clothes on a shed, a child's dress, hanging on a hook. New York Herald, January 6, 1895 Fires in the home of Adam Caldwell, 84, Guernsey Street, Greenpoint, Brooklyn. That, in 20 hours, preceding noon, January 5, when Caldwell's frame house burned down, there had been many fires. Policemen had been sent to investigate. They had seen furniture burst into flames. Policemen and firemen had reported that the fires were of unknown origin. The fire marshal said, "It might be thought that the child Rhoda started two of the fires, but she cannot be considered guilty of the others, as she was being questioned when some of them began." I do not want to be quoted as a believer in the supernatural, but I have no explanation to offer as to the cause of the fires, or of the throwing around of the furniture. Caldwell's story was that, upon the afternoon of January 4, in the presence of his wife and his stepdaughter Rhoda, aged 16, a crash was heard. A large, empty, parlor stove had fallen to the floor. Four pictures fell from walls. Caldwell had been out. Upon his return, while hearing an account of what had occurred, he smelled smoke. A bed was afire. He called a policeman, Roundsman Daly, who put out the fire, and then, because of unaccountable circumstances, remained in the house. It was said that the roundsman saw wallpaper, near the shoulder of Caldwell's son Willie, start to burn. Detective Sergeant Dunn arrived. There was another fire, and a heavy lamp fell from a hook. The house burned down, and the Caldwells, who were in poor circumstances, lost everything but their clothes. They were taken to the police station.